Welcome to American Highways. You're listening to Guy Livingston, and this is Concert Cinema Radio. This series is entitled Keys of Change. We'll be featuring musicians whose art has responded strongly and resolutely to political forces around them. Today's show features Charles Ives and Conlon Nancarrow. Let's open with Variations on America by Charles Ives, performed by the Philadelphia Orchestra under the baton of Eugene Ormandy. At first glance, a purely patriotic work, but watch out for the dissonances, complexities, and contradictions. There's more to this than meets the ear.
Thank you.
That's my favorite version of the Charles Ives Variations on America in the orchestration by William Schumann, performance conducted by Eugene Ormandy. This series grew out of a conversation I had a few years ago with composer and improviser Donnell Fox. We began arguing about the relevance of race in music and realized that our conflicting ideas made for good dialogue. Hence the inspiration for Keys of Change. I've chosen 10 musicians for whom politics has played a major role. Some, like Paul Robeson and Mark Blitzstein, sympathize with communists. Others, like Charles Ives, were more conservative. Some, like Lotta Lenya, were unwillingly dragged into politics and kept their distance even while their music encouraged others. Alternatively, Gene Pritzker has thrown himself into political activism using his music to project an intensely personal message. Although this series, which is entirely subjective, of course, it serves to some extent as an historical survey, the real focus is the stories, which are intended to be more pointed, more understandable. Today's show is focusing on Conlon Nancarrow and Charles Ives. In addition to being the American composer of the 20th century, Ives was a successful insurance executive. Given what you might already know about Ives's character, you won't be surprised to hear that he was rather an unconventional business leader. His plans for the insurance business drew from both capitalist and communist theory, not to mention the ideas of independence and philosophies of Thoreau and Emerson. He saw insurance policies as an equalizer in society and espoused them as such, to the bafflement of his peers. Fascinatingly, he managed to make a lot of money for his company, despite, or perhaps because of, his unconventional ideas. He practiced what he preached, too. Though he could have made millions, he chose to reinvest most of his income in the company, taking only what he considered to be a fair salary. Ives advocated equality in income and equality in voices. Here's his song, a political song, entitled The Majority, The Masses. Of Charles Ives, The Majority. So what's going on here? A Wall Street insurance executive writing avant-garde music about the masses? Is this credible? Well, some people have argued that Ives' physical breakdown in 1907 was due to the impossibility of reconciling his conflicting viewpoints. I totally disagree. He was burning the candle at both ends, doing an incredible amount of composing, and running a company simultaneously. But his insurance work, his political lobbying, and his music are all of a piece. It all fits together. He believed in music for the people, insurance for the people, and government for the people. Alas, he never achieved anything with his political lobbying, except that people thought him something of a crank. But he never gave up, either. Let's hear Charles Ives himself in an exceptional recording from 1943. This is a ray of hope from a very complex man, a pro-war song from an anti-war philosopher. Ives is yelling and shouting and playing the piano in some tiny sound studio in Manhattan, just for himself.
There's a time in many a life on his own.
His unambiguous anthem, or rather ambiguous anthem, They Are There, advocates a people's new free world. He's in a recording studio in Manhattan, desperately and impatiently trying to record this song, which is called They Are There, simultaneously pro-war and pro-peace. It's messy, cranky, choleric. This performance incarnates all the contradictions and passion of Charles Ives.
Liberty for all. Hip, hip, hooray, you'll hear them say, as they go to war.
close out this chapter on Charles Ives with music from three places in New England. Entitled The St. Gaudens Memorial in Boston Common, this is a tribute to the black regiments who fought in the Civil War. They are commemorated in a tragic and heroic sculpture on the Common by the artist St. Gaudens. I've spent a summer writing this piece in their honor. You're listening to Keys of Change, a special series from Concertzender Radio, Utrecht, the Netherlands. I'm your host, Guy Livingston. Naturally, certain types of music are more appropriate to politics than others. Rap, opera, and folk music have much to say about struggle and strife. So, can art music be political? Classical music? Absolutely. We're listening to Verdi's Nabucco. Yes, it's true that orchestral music might seem less relevant politically, and that European classical composers definitely have less of a reputation for political engagement. But in their own time, artists such as Mozart and Beethoven explored social and political issues. Indeed, some classical composers inspired intense controversy. And Verdi's music, for example, became the powerful soundtrack to the Italian Risorgimento, the nationalist movement which united the Italian kingdoms in 1861. When Italians sang the chorus of the Hebrew slaves from his opera Nabucco, it symbolized all their pent-up frustration and longing for the promised land. His operas provided the anthems for unification, the artistic symbols for a new country. Verdi went on to serve 4 years in the newly formed parliament. In this episode of Keys of Change, we're talking politics and music. Let's focus in on the composer Conlon Nancarrow, who wrote extraordinarily dense music for player pianos. Here is his study number 3A, which draws on ragtime, rock music, and complex mathematical equations.
Thank you. Years I'd been obsessed with this idea of player pianos and, I mean, somehow to do it on it. And I went to New York asking all over the place, people who, there were places that made player piano roles. Oh, this is an interesting story, incidentally. I don't know, did I ever tell you this story about how I found out about making a machine?
No, never did.
Oh, well, I'll tell you now.
Okay, great.
This is really folkloric.
All right.
No, I first went to this place in where was it? In the Bronx. This player piano company that had a... as a matter of fact, I think they still make rolls. Now it's just popular music. And I found this one guy there who was... he's very cooperative and... helped me and everything. He had in this company, they make the thing with, I told you about these big machines that run things out, wholesale. But he had this little machine that he used for, I don't know what the things he was doing with for punching. You know, it was similar to mine. As a matter of fact, this was copied from his machine. Well, after that, I was somewhere down in the village. It was a really strange character. You know, I forget all these people's names. He, you know what he did? Only repaired medieval instruments, lutes and who knows what. I mean, a real character. And I was in there, I was talking with but a very interesting guy. And I was telling him my problem, how are we going to make a machine that I said, I know someone who has a machine. I want it sort of copied, the measurements and everything. He said, look, I have a good friend who's has a machine shop. It's a strange combination, this medieval music shop. And so, he got his machine shop friend, and all of us went up to the guy who had this steel here, and you go this and whatever. And between the two of them, they worked out made this machine for him.
Made a design for
him? No, even much better than the other guys. Because I told him, later I changed that also, so that it was even better yet. But those two guys, also they gave me in 1948, I guess, 47, I don't remember. And, they gave me a project of $300 to make this machine. And I had to stay there in New York for 3 months, and problems came up, this, that, and the other.
Oh, you were living in Mexico at the time. You came up for the...
Only time I've gone to the States since came here.
Since
1940. Oh. And $300, and it was months and months and months. And after it was finished, this guy said to me, okay, I've told you $300, but if I had to do it again, I'd charge you I don't know what. Uh-huh. No. And that time I was a little short on money, and so... So I came back, brought it back, and several years later, when I had some more money, I sent this guy $500, sort of a...
I should add at this point that Nancarrow's music was not composed as political, and any attempt to make it political is probably ignoring his personality and his intentions. There is no subtext, except perhaps one about isolation, machines, and human limitations. The reason I'm including Nancarrow in this series is because of his own life and his own convictions, which led him to seek refuge in a country not his own. Kanlan Nancarrow was an iconoclastic American composer who wrote in an utterly new way, using new instrumental resources and few or sometimes no performers. While isolated from the main currents of music, he was virtually ignored by the public and his colleagues until the late 1970s. Here is Kanlan Nankara again in study number 21. We'll hear two versions, back to back. One is the original pianola version, and the other is arranged for wind quintet, performed by the Dutch ensemble Califax.
Thank you.
Here's composer Kanlan Nancarrow in conversation with Charles Amerikanian.
No, he was discussing this thing of electronic or mechanical or whatever, music. And he said, you know, I go to a concert, and to me it's so exciting. He said, I don't want the first horn to miss the note, but the fact that he might miss it, the tension of might miss it. No, but I told him, I said, well, I'd rather have a good recording where he hit the note. I mean, not where he might not hit it. No, he said, that's very boring because, you know he's going to hit it. And also, you know, this whole thing of that's a whole cultural thing, I mean, traditional, of people who go to concerts and this whole atmosphere, the orchestra tuning up and that's another point of view, that's all.
Yeah.
I don't... That's what soured me on music for a short time. This horrible piano teacher I had at the age of 4, I don't know. Naturally, I never learned to play anything. So,
but then you played trumpet for quite a while, I guess.
Oh, yeah. In
his early years, Nancarrow played jazz trumpet and enrolled in the Cincinnati College Conservatory of Music in 1929. He went to Boston for private study with Nicholas Leminski, Walter Piston, and Roger Sessions. At the outbreak of the Spanish Civil War in 1937, Nancarrow joined the Lincoln Brigade, an organization of Americans fighting for the Loyalists against General Franco. On his return to the United States in 1939, the State Department confiscated his passport for communist associations. Fearing persecution, Nancarrow moved to Mexico City and did not return to the States for the next 40 years. He composed in obscurity for most of that time and then, thanks to the efforts of Charles Amerikanian, was honored, at the age of 70, with a MacArthur Genius Award.
Look, I have much more control temporally with these than these electronic composers have. I mean, they're just not interested in the temporal thing. I mean, the pitches and the sound qualities, the atmospheric effects. Well, that's very interesting, except my main interest... Look, I've always thought of, if I could have a thing like this with rolls, like this, with all of the gamut of sounds of electronic music, to me, that would be the ultimate. But these electronic composers are not interested in that control. That's also unlimited, really, in the sense of... I told you this story, no? Whether I told you or you heard about it. This thing, when they first started making a lot of electronic music sounds, they made a sound of a flute. And people objected because the flute didn't have the wheeze of a flute player. Well, they put in the wheeze. You can put anything you want. You can put in the scratch of the violin bow or anything. It's unlimited. I mean, the sounds. I don't think I've heard one piece that I felt was interesting temporally.
Here's composer Kanlan Nancarrow in conversation with Charles Amerikanian.
Who'd you listen to in jazz? What kind of musicians were you?
Father Hines, Louis Armstrong, and Bessie Smith. Those were always my favorites. Huh?
You still listen to them from time to time? Or?
With these old 78s. It was a few years ago, I got a reissue on LP of the Louis Armstrong. The old Hot 5 and Hot 7.
Oh, yeah.
So, no, I still play those. As I've told you, that I'm interested in this temporal thing. And for me, let's say you have two times going, two tempi going at the same time. And if you have one going and something else and whatever, If you have them both at the same, let's say, melodic proportions, it's easier to follow the temporal changes. So, in other words, if you know, say one starts off this way, if it's the same melody, you don't have to follow the melody. You're just hearing the temporal relationship. Oh, probably also. No, oh yeah, I'd forgotten about this. This is, I forget who pointed this out to me. I don't have much of a, what do you call it, melodic imagination or invention. So if it's the same melody going, I mean, it's easier for me. I just have to do it once.
No, it's funny. We were talking about how you have more of a relationship to the rhythms in the pieces than the harmonies.
Yeah.
But the harmonies are lovely. And so the resulting counterpoint is just extraordinary. Everything about the pieces is wonderful. And
I only have to do the melody once, right, in a canon. A four-part canon, it's just one melody.
Well, maybe that's enough, huh? Well,
we've been listening to music of American composer Conlon Nancarrow, who sought and found political refuge in Mexico. This is the end of the hour for our first political program entitled Keys of Change. I'm Guy Livingston for Concert Center Radio. This broadcast was brought to you with support from the Amphion Foundation. My next episode will feature Paul Robeson and Mark Blitzstein. Let's close out this hour with a concert band version of Charles Ives' song, They Are There.